we've seen then, brethren and sisters, so far, that the collapse of atheistic communism has left the way open for the rising again of Christendom. That's really the substance of what we have said so far. Now, we want to look at this in perspective, and so I want to go right back to the beginning of things now to show where things went wrong in the early Christian church to begin with. And if you will come with me, please, first of all, to James chapter 4 and verse 4. The church, since early times, brethren and sisters, has sought wrongly, should not have done so, but she has sought for worldly power. And James chapter 4 and verse 4 was one of the early things that the apostle had to write to the people of that time, where he told them, "Ye adulterers," and he means that in a spiritual sense, of course, "Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God." And brothers and sisters, that was a very important principle to be understood at that time. There were those in the ecclesias of those times, we read about it, who did in fact, we just read of some who went out into the world. The Apostle Paul in Timothy's letter writes of somebody by the name of Demas who had forsaken him, having loved this present world. Now there is the issue that we spoke about before. And brothers and sisters, that issue is still with us today. The world or the truth? But in the first century, let's turn to that passage in First Letter of John that we just looked at. The apostle is emphasizing this very strongly in the words that we just read together. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 19. Verse 15. "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him." Friendship with the world, James says, is enmity with God. John says, don't love the world and the things that are of the world. That isn't of the Father, he says. For all that, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the things of the world are temporary and passing away. But there were certain teachers, it seems, and they played to the world. Just skip over the page to chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4 speaks about these people. Verse 1, he says, "Believe not, beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world," he says. And verse 5, "They," that's the false prophets, "they are of the world, therefore speak they of the world, and the world hears them." And today, when you get religious leaders with a great following in the world, the same principle is true. Now, these people, it tells us in verse 19 of chapter 2, left the meeting. "They went out from us," it says, verse 19, "but they were not of us. For if they had been of us," that means the Apostle Paul saying, if they were really members of the meeting, "they would no doubt have continued with us. But they went out that they might be made manifest," that they would be revealed. You know, the apostle said in Thessalonians that he would be revealed in his time. He would be made manifest. That's it there. That's right it there. "They went out that they might be made manifest," or revealed. Let's go to that passage, shall we, in 2 Thessalonians. Second Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come this falling away or apostasy from the truth first, and that man of sin be revealed or apocalypsed, the son of perdition. And so it goes on to describe him there in verse 4, that he would oppose and exalt himself. That's it. The power of the world. He would lift himself up to such a position that he would even occupy the temple of God, it says. What's that mean? The apostle is not speaking here, brothers and sisters, of the temple in Jerusalem. He's not talking about that. He hasn't got that in mind at all. What actually happened with this apostasy, you can see, is that it took over the power and position of Caesar himself. That's what he did. Because as the apostasy developed, it grew, and if you want to see anything in the world today which is a reflection or a remnant or a vestige, whatever you want to call it, of the Roman Empire, well then you have it in what you see in the Vatican. It is the image of the old Roman Empire. And the titles and everything still come through. Pontifex Maximus, of course, was one of the titles that Caesar had and which the Pope has today. The power of Caesar, the god of that time, and he was. People had to worship statues of Caesar in those times. Perhaps difficult for us to make that connection always because we're so far away from it and we're not used to sort of, many of us perhaps wouldn't be aware that that's what happened, but it was the case, and so that would be what happened. And most, I think, probably don't appreciate, unless you are a little bit of a history buff or something like that, you probably don't appreciate the power that was, I use the word enjoyed, because I think they did enjoy it, the power that was held by the church in earlier times. I put a map on the screen here, and the colours have not come out. Oh well, all right. it's coloured when you look at it on there, but it isn't on the screen. So that's unfortunate, because the impression won't hit you quite as well. But anyway, it depicts the land that was owned and ruled over by the church in the Middle Ages. You can probably see that this is Europe here. Sorry for these people over here if you can't see too well. But that's the middle of Europe there, the Holy Roman Empire. And the papacy ruled this piece of land here, and it was called the Papal States, and probably a lot of people are familiar with that. But what they don't realise is the fact that dotted here, all over this map, it's quite big areas, all over are the church lands that were owned by the church during the whole of the Middle Ages. They owned that land, they ruled it, the Pope was like it were the king, and it was scattered all over the whole of Europe. They had big pieces of land. I think it's been estimated that at certain times it amounted to a third of all the land of Europe was owned and ruled over directly by the Pope in the days of his temporal power. Now, that's quite a that's quite a powerful position that was enjoyed. Well, we want to go through now quickly and just see how this has developed, because it's going to give us a perspective on current events that's happening today. The Roman Catholic power in Europe then was probably at its peak during the period which ran from Justinian right through to the French Revolution, which happens to be a significant period of time because it was 1260 years. It's a 1260 year period, which is quite important as far as prophecy is concerned. We won't stay with that though. What we're concerned about is that it was at its peak during that time, and there was tremendous power and wealth. It was the days of the selling of indulgences, things like that, and the church would rake in tremendous wealth from people who were serfs, who were labouring on the land from early in the morning till the setting sun, never owned it at all. They were just like tenants, and they did all the work and planted the seeds and reaped the harvest, and all the money, of course, went in the equivalent of their taxes and so on to the church. And that was the position in the most of Europe for many centuries. And it was the French Revolution in 1789 that really started things going badly for the church. Because at the time of the French Revolution, all the church lands in France were confiscated, all the church property was taken over, a lot of the priests were executed. It was a terrible time for them. And the Napoleonic Wars that we have just here went on, taking the revolution over into other parts of Europe, until such a time that even the Pope himself was taken prisoner at the outset of all that. There's just an old engraving of the event, when actually the forces of Napoleon went to Rome and they took the Pope prisoner. So right from such a powerful position, you see, he'd come right down to the fact where he was a prisoner. And it really was a judgment upon the papal times. Back to our chart. That went on. There was some reinstatement of the Pope back in Rome again afterwards, until finally in 1870 he completely lost the temporal power that he had. That's the no longer a king in the full sense, and so he was taken out of the way in that manner. The move that was made, however, was extremely clever, because when the same year that the Pope lost his temporal power and couldn't do the things that he used to do anymore, do you know what he did? He declared himself infallible. That is when the infallibility of the Pope was declared, the same year as when he was when he lost his temporal power. And so what he was doing, you see, was this: the papacy had a two-pronged power. One was what you call the civil power, where he was king and he ruled in that way, and he was all through the emperors as well in the Holy Roman Empire, places like that. That was the civil power, and they would use the sword and so on and so forth. There was the other side to it, what they call the spiritual power. And the papacy, therefore, was strengthening its spiritual power when it lost its civil power. And he says, right, if I'm going to fight with one arm, I'm going to make it as strong as ever I can. From now on, I am infallible. What a blasphemy, as far as we're concerned. But that's what he said, and that's what he did. And, strange as it may seem to us, when he did that, over the years that followed, the papacy increased its power, its influence, I should say, its influence in Europe. The main items upon which the Protestant Reformation had been founded were largely overcome, and the Catholic Church, which in Protestant lands at that time had been rather frowned upon and was very unpopular, and in fact outlawed even in Britain at one time, the Catholic Church was illegal in the sense that no one being of the Catholic religion could take part in any office in the land. It was, in fact, even still today, there's the vestige of that in the coronation, in the, what do they call it now, the Act of Settlement, I think that's what it is, where even today a Roman Catholic cannot occupy the throne of Great Britain. It's against the law for them to do so. That's still today, that is. And so you see that there was a great force against this power of the papacy. But as time went on, by means and ways around, they got it, and there was what they call the emancipation of Catholicism in the 19th century, and gradually they got their influence back again. And they built it up, and particularly they built it up in Germany. And as we approach to the time of the First World War, a man by the name of Bismarck got together all the pieces of the German Confederation which Napoleon had set up in place of the Holy Roman Empire. There had been the Holy Roman Empire, which ruled the centre of Europe. Napoleon shattered that, and then as we come towards the First World War, a man by the name of Bismarck got all those pieces together, and he built up what was called the German Empire, or in German it was the Second Reich. Now that led to the First World War, and what it was the attempt to reimpose the church's authority, or to revive, if you like, the old Holy Roman Empire. That's what had happened. And Germany was the tool through which the papacy, the Vatican of that time, tried to do that. But it backfired on them. How did it backfire, you say? Well, for one thing, Germany lost the war. But more important than that, whilst that was going on, we had the birth in Russia of atheistic communism. 1917 it was, the Russian Revolution came along, and the Lenin, I think it was at the time, wasn't it, was the Bolshevik Revolution, and they instated in Russia communism with atheism as its official position. Of course, the church was outlawed and all the rest of it, so it was like a throwback for them. It was a repeat of the French Revolution in Russia type of thing. That's what it came down to. Well, that was rather a shock. The Reformation was hard enough to deal with, but how do you deal with atheism? What hope had the church got now? Well, when that happened, there was a vision, supposedly, given to three children in Fatima, in Portugal. And it is said that the Virgin Mary appeared to these three children. Somebody in the back of the room over there smiling, they know about it, obviously. There was prophecies made and handed to these children, which they, in turn, had to hand to the Pope. And it was kept sealed, and nobody was to know what it was all about. Except this. Russia must be converted. That was the power of this message, supposedly. Supposed message. It went further than that. Either Russia must be converted, or the world is going to be destroyed by a terrible war. That was the burden of this supposed message. But what that did, brethren and sisters, was it put into the hands of the people an object, and it was associated with Mary, and it became a religious object to have the conversion of Russia brought about. Well, now, got all kinds of people going to Fatima and praying for world peace, which meant the conversion of Russia had to come about. And so that was quite a movement and went on for quite some time there, known as the Fatima cult. And all the time, the influence of the Catholic Church is growing in Europe. And the opposition to socialism is the general heading. Communism is a sort of a subheading, if you like, because it's one of the doctrines of socialism, isn't it? The Vatican made its opposition known to socialism. Now, this is an important stage of history, and we want to understand this. In 1931, the Pope issued an encyclical called The Social Order. Copy of it here. And in here he states his policy very clearly. I'll just read to you one short paragraph. Whether considered as a doctrine, or as a historical fact, or as a movement, socialism, if it really remains socialism, cannot be brought into harmony with the dogmas of the Catholic Church, even if after it has yielded to truth and justice. The reason being that it conceives human society in a way utterly alien to Christian truth. Now, you couldn't have a more direct opposition to socialism, and by socialism they include communism, of course, than that, could you? Definitely right against it. That was 1931. Then steps were taken, brethren and sisters, steps were taken to do something about it. This photograph here is an amazing photograph, really. It is the signing of the Concordat between Nazi Germany and the Vatican. And the people that are on the photograph there, probably can't recognize them all if you're sitting at a distance, but they are there. And we have a very notable fellow here by the name of Franz von Papen, and he was the main diplomat, if you like, of the Vatican operating with Nazi Germany. Signing the Concordat is Pacelli here. He became Pius XII. He was actually a later pope, signing this Concordat with Nazi Germany. And over here on this side, right up there, you can just see him, is the man who later became Paul the Sixth, the Pope Paul the Sixth. That was the one that came before the Pope John, that brought about all the changes. An amazing photograph showing the Concordat that was made with Nazi Germany and the Vatican. Now, brothers and sisters, we never hear about these things, do we? Why not? Why is it that we don't speak about them? It's part of truth. It was stated by Hitler in Mein Kampf that communism had to be destroyed. Now, you put that alongside the little message that those three little girls are supposed to have received in 1917, that communism, that Russia had to be converted. Hitler policy was that communism must be destroyed, and those are his words in Mein Kampf. And historians since, as a matter of fact, my son bought me a very interesting CD for during the holiday season there, and it was a recordings made from Nazi Germany during World War II. These are the actual sounds that were from there. Well, on the write-up, on the little card, you know, you get a little card in these things that are there, it tells you that Nazism was a move, a Christian movement, against atheistic communism. Isn't that incredible? And this is what happened. We know that Hitler went to war with Russia. We know what happened as a result of it. I mean, he lost the war, but you can see behind it. And it was called the Third Reich. The Holy Roman Empire was the first empire, Bismarck's Germany was the second empire, and the third one was the Third Reich. It was the third empire, and they were again trying to re-establish the old Holy Roman Empire. It was trying to bring them back into power once again. It didn't work, of course. These overheads are showing pictures, of course, of the deals between the, there's Hitler himself with Bishop Müller of Germany, shaking hands on very good terms at the time that this Concordat would have been in place. Now, brothers and sisters, these are significant things to us, and we must realize the truth of the fact that the Vatican's attempt was to regain power through Mussolini in Italy and Hitler in Germany and what was called the Rome-Berlin Axis. And just as you see the concordat made with Hitler, so it was that Mussolini also, of course, earlier had made a concordat with the Vatican, and as part of that the Pope received what is now Vatican City as his own place and so on, and a vast sum of money as well. Tremendous thing that happened, and the whole idea was to put away atheistic communism. Interesting, isn't it, that it's happened. Where we are now, all those, it failed back then, but it happened. After the war, there was the struggle against atheistic communism continued. And we want to look at that. The power of the USA in particular comes into play there. Now, just following this through with you, to just get this background to be able to appreciate where we're going here. After World War II, there was a plan. You see, brothers and sisters, you don't appreciate that the observing power of the Vatican is second to none in the world. I mean that. I had cause just recently to be absolutely amazed at the ability of men to be able to see which way the wind is blowing. And in a document I was reading just the other day, as early as 1973, the Vatican was saying, Russia's finished, she's going down the tubes. Soviet Union, rather. She'd already was on to it. She just sees the slightest little thing and she can tell. The document said she's now moving to a position of compromise, back in 73. Amazing. As far as World War II was concerned, which was raging away there, by about 1942 or so, they would be able to know that Germany was going to lose the war. And so alternative plans would have to be made. And so the plan was, as we've got on the screen there, to prepare America. She looks around the world, who's the strongest ally we can possibly get hold of? America was obviously the one, and America had to be prepared, and of course with NATO, for the military defeat of atheistic communism. And you had the beginning of what they would call the Cold War coming about. And of course it came to a head, I believe one of the main turning points, although it didn't become manifest for some years later, was when the Roman Catholic President Kennedy, he was, threatened to press the nuclear button. Remember the Cuban missile crisis, many of you will do so, putting into exactly what that message had said in Fatima. Either Russia must be converted or the world will be destroyed. And she meant it. Yes, there is no length to which they will not go. That is the wickedness of this system. And they were prepared to press the nuclear button at the time of the Cuban missile crisis. And whatever we might think about the communists and all the rest of it, it was Khrushchev that backed down. He backed away from that. And brothers and sisters, we talk about Islamic fundamentalism and their fanatic ways that they will go into battle. Believe me, there's a power worse than that. There is. And so it was that things moved away. Now, if the military defeat, if it wasn't going to come about that way, then we must have another plan. And that plan was Plan B on the screen, to reach an accommodation with the Soviet and move to defeat atheistic communism ideologically. Now, these things that I'm talking to you about, brothers and sisters, if you wish to inform yourself about them, there are books available, and you can do so. It's a question of whether you want to know. I find, quite honestly, I'll tell you, I find that many people just don't want to know. But there are books available that will tell you this information. I think one of the classic ones is a book entitled The Vatican Against Europe. And it was written by a French writer, Edmond Paris. You may be able to get it through library, university library loans and things like that, I believe. You won't find it in print anywhere today. It's long since vanished off the bookstores. I think after 3 or 4 weeks after publication, there was not a copy of that book to be had anywhere. It was just gone. And it wasn't just bought by interested readers, however, by the way. But when it came clear that Germany was going to lose World War II, the Vatican think tank, and that would be basically your Jesuit movement, if you're aware of that, they began to work out what future policy is going to be then. And it was all put together. I have mentioned this to you before in a previous class, but I need to bring it in now again just for to put the picture together. This Jesuit priest by the name of Teilhard de Chadron, he published some notes. I just forget the date of the publication of them now, 1958, somewhere about there, 1950s anyway. He was an evolutionist. It's difficult to understand all this, but to comprehend why it would happen. But here he is. He's a Jesuit priest, okay? But he's an evolutionist. He is what they call a paleontologist. Now, he makes it his business to study bones and say, oh yeah, this evolved from that to that and that to that and that to that. So that's what he was. He was a professional paleontologist. Now, this man believed in man evolving. But he didn't just believe in a physical evolution. Oh no. But much further than that, he believed that the human race was evolving its social future. So that what he looked for was that man would get better and better and better. And what he called the parousia of the kingdom of God on earth would eventually be established through a process of evolution. Strange to us, but that's the way he believed it. Of course, it's a false gospel, because it isn't going to happen. Man is not of himself going to evolve in that way to get better and better. But anyway, that was Teilhard de Chadron, and that's what he thought. This is a page out of his book. It's called The Future of Man. And in The Future of Man, making it very simple for us, he draws a very simple diagram. You can see it on there. Y leading to O, O leading to X, and there it is. That's his diagram. What's it mean? This line, Y-O, represents, he says, faith in God. Okay? From man on earth, looking up there, okay, faith in God. That's that line. That's what that represents. The line from O to X here, that represents faith in man, as you have in socialism, communism, and so on like that. Now, the idea stated was that Christianity must assimilate the principles of communism. And the way he put it was like this. And to us, this seems dreadful, but it's the way he put it. That as the Word of God became flesh in the incarnation of Jesus Christ, so communism, so rather the Christianity, through communism, would be an incarnation. It's a blasphemous kind of way of looking at it. Of course it is. But that is the thinking that was behind it. And so he produced what he called a rectified line there. Rectified religion. And under the subtitle Unite or Perish, he worked out a compromise between Marxism and Catholicism. That was Plan B. If you can't beat them, join them. Okay? That was the idea. And so the ideas that he had expressed found official voice in the early 1960s through Vatican Council II. That is the title page of an encyclical that was published at the time of Vatican Council II, and you can see the title of it, New Light on Social Problems. Previously, before the war, 1931, I quoted to you the encyclical, didn't I, that completely said socialism can have nothing to do with the church, that it's a no-no, can't be reconciled. Now he's saying, well, just a minute, perhaps we could. And so this compromise that Teilhard had put together is brought into being here in Vatican Council II. And you'll see since then the socialist emphasis that is given in all these encyclicals. Here's this one. This is the first encyclical published by the present Pope, and it's to do with human work and the place of the worker, the rights of the worker, and the proper place of the unions, and so on and so forth and so on. It's a completely, in fact, when it was published, it was called a Marxist document. That's what it was seen as. And this has worked, brethren and sisters, until the church, I think I've shown you that very overhead before on this topic, but the church was against capitalism for a Christianized socialism. That's what came about. Here is a map which shows, this is back in 81 of course, the countries of Europe, and it shows you how they are all ruled by socialist-oriented governments. There's Italy there, Greece there, Germany, Switzerland, Finland, all those European, Netherlands is in there, all socialist governments at the time. And it's carried on that same way right throughout. Well, this is what began to be called for, and I've shown you that overhead before just for the heading. I want this time to show you a little something inside it, what he says. I should have made another copy for me to read. Pope John Paul II yesterday appealed for a united Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals and condemned curbs on religious freedom in Eastern Europe. This is back in 1987 now. And then, he says over here, the Pope said a spiritually united Europe would offer the world a liberating message which will show people and populations a future worth aspiring to. But it's that phrase there, a spiritually united Europe. This was back in 87, when half of Europe was still officially atheistic. It was communist countries. We know that there were strong Catholic populations there. But nonetheless, that was when, that was before all the wall came down and all this thing happened. The Pope was calling for a spiritually united Europe. What are we seeing, brothers and sisters? It's exactly that, isn't it? The atheistic communism has gone, and you've got coming together this spiritually united Europe. This was reviewing events in 1989 when the wall came down. The wall did come down, and Poland came into the picture. And straight out here, this is out of Time magazine, It tells you quite clearly the part that was played in the Vatican in bringing it about. And there they are around the table, the church talking to the leaders of Poland at the time. The result was Poland officially recognizes the Roman Catholic Church. It was a breakthrough. That was a breakthrough. And they had made that compromise and it had worked. Whereas Hitler's method with the military had not worked, this worked. They were getting through. You know, it wasn't for nothing they elected a Polish pope, by no means. Not for nothing that happened. And so the message and the policy continued. The Pope calls for the creation of a united Europe. And pushing forward all the time, John Paul II, he's pushing all the time, Mary, 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 worship of Mary. What was Mary's message at Fatima? Russia must be converted. This has been the mission of this Pope. He's accomplished it. It's an incredible thing that we see. And so, of course, he called for, what's the date on that one? 1989. This is when it all started to come down. The Pope moots a united Christian Europe. Pope John Paul speaking from the mountains where the 800-year reconquest of Spain from Muslims, notice, invaders began yesterday, called for a united Christian Europe without frontiers. I faithfully propose, he says, the project of a Europe without frontiers which acknowledges the Christian roots that are at its origin. He's talking to East and West Europe when he's saying this. Get back to your Christian roots, he's saying, and it all sounds good. The Christian kingdom born in these mountains gave birth to a style of life and existence inspired by the gospel, says the Pope. This Christian kingdom, Christendom, that's what he's talking about. The Polish-born pontiff has in the past called for a united Christian Europe stretching from the Atlantic to the Urals. Of course he's including Russia. And this has been the policy, as I've tried to explain to you, right since the birth of communism in 1917. And the policy has been there, the attempts have been made, and now finally it's been achieved. Brothers and sisters, we should understand this. And in looking at Europe, Time magazine, I'm afraid the colours aren't going to come out again, I guess, but there it is. Time magazine issued this, I don't know how many of you saw it, just a few weeks ago. Remind you of something? Incredible. And there's the woman, and just the way that the artist has placed the flag, he's put a crown of 12 stars around her head. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 1. There she is, mounted upon the beast. Brothers and sisters, these are incredible things that we're seeing. Incredible things that we are seeing. And it is amazing to people as they look at it, and we read in Scripture that they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not, and yet is. There it is, brothers and sisters. A system that once existed and disappeared, amazingly, comes back into existence again. Brothers and sisters, it is incredible, isn't it? I don't know how many of you have seen that before, but it was painted, I believe, by a brother. But it points out, doesn't it? Exactly. A woman, so nice to look at from a distance, mounted upon the beast. But if you look very closely, you won't see it on this overhead, I'd have to put an enlargement on. But trickling out of her mouth is blood. And it's the blood that she is drunk with. It is the blood of the martyrs of Jesus Christ who have suffered down the ages at the hands of this system. How can we say it doesn't all matter? Brothers and sisters, these are the things that confront us. This European beast, I want to try to just get across now something that might just clear up a confusion that some may have. And it's this, that this whole system, when it comes together, is going to be initially under the control of Gog. It's going to be under the control of the Russian military power. Now, exactly how that's going to come about, we don't know. But the land of Magog, as you may know, in Ezekiel chapter 38, refers directly to Germany. And it is the land of Magog, Germany, that's going to be involved in this. And we could use a whole class here, brothers and sisters, but we obviously can't do it. But we could show how that Germany will, in fact, already is involved in revitalizing Russia. And the sense of that is to put her back on her feet. I was only listening to the radio just the day before I came down, caught the news. I listened to the BBC from London. And it was saying how that Germany has been appointed, I think it was by the United Nations, I just miss it, it might have been Europe. But she has been appointed as the coordinator for all aid that is going to be channeled to Russia. Now, the sense of all this, from a human point of view at this stage for Germany, is that she's developing a market, a vast market in Eastern Europe and Russia. That's how she will look at it at the moment. Fine, put Russia on its feet and the Eastern European countries. You've got a tremendous market there for you to do business with, and you're going to become rich and it's going to do you good, and Germany will elevate until she dominates Europe. Germany's ambitions, you know, brothers and sisters, I hope there's no Germans here, I wouldn't want to offend anybody, I'm just looking at this from a purely prophetic sense now, but Germany's mission has always been the same, and it hasn't changed. The Holy Roman Empire, which is what it was originally, ruled Europe. First World War tried to reinstate it, Second World War tried to reinstate it, and she hasn't given up. Believe you me, she has not given up. She will dominate Europe economically. She already does, to all intents and purposes. She's in a bit of a backwater just now because she's making vast expenditure in setting up, or renewing, shall we say, all the broken down equipment and so on in Eastern Europe. You know, she's just taken over Eastern Germany, I mean. And she's just got to revitalize, she's got to pump all the dollars in, or the marks, or whatever it is, to get that economy going. It's been stagnant, it's dead. And she's got to get it going, and of course it's a vast expenditure. But you just give it a couple of years, and that will bring tremendous response back again. And it will elevate Germany up so that she will be higher. Now Germany is putting that, she's blacked her books, you see. She can't build up her own military power again. Not now. The nations wouldn't stand for it. But by a deal with Russia, she's going to build up Russia's military power. And she's pumping in all the aid. And you read about it, I'm sure, how that all this is going there. And it's a great effort. And it will succeed. We don't know exactly the turns it's going to take. And, you know, somebody was saying the other day, give Boris Yeltsin till April and he's gone, somebody was saying. That might be true. Who's going to take his place? A man by the name of Gog? Don't know. I mean, you know, we don't know the various phases that this will have to go through. But the general outline of the way things are going is you can see that it's being built up. Now, it's that system which will embrace the whole of Europe under Russia's military might and Gog's leadership, with the aid of Germany's help and everything that's going into that, that will come. Oh dear, shut that off this time. It's not the right place to stop. He's going to build it up. Now that's stage one. And all that force in the shape of Nebuchadnezzar's image, if you like, or Ezekiel chapter 38, if you prefer that, it's the same thing, comes against the mountains of Israel and is broken to pieces by the appearance of Christ and the saints. That's stage one. But then there is a regrouping, and there is a stage two. The military might of Russia will be gone. But round the papacy will gather the nations of Europe, and there will be stage two, when the power of Europe then will finally be broken, and we read about that, the judgments upon the whore of Babylon and so on, as coming out of Psalm 2, particularly. You'll see there where the kings of the earth, and that's relating particularly to the European side of things, the kings of the earth will gather themselves together against the Lord and against his anointed, and they come against him, and then there is the final overthrow that follows that. But see it in two stages. The beast system arises, Russia its military thing, it comes down on the mountains of Israel, is smashed. Then the pieces get together, as it were, as a second resistance in Europe, and then it is finally crushed. Daniel chapter 2 puts it in this light, that the image is broken in pieces, and then it is ground to powder, and the wind comes and blows it away like the chaff. So there is the breaking to pieces, and then there is the grinding to powder. And then you get those two stages that we are to look for. Ezekiel 38 is like this. Ezekiel 38, you read the chapter, okay, you see this force destroyed on the mountains of Israel. You come to Ezekiel chapter 39, and you'll see that separately now there is a fire sent upon Magog and those that dwell carelessly in the coastlands, as it puts it. And so you see that there's the second stage. And the fire is sent upon Magog and those that dwell in the coastlands there, which is referring to the European scene, and that is the second stage of it. Now, brothers and sisters, of all people, as I have said, we, the Christadelphians, I was going to say just ought to recognize God's enemy. I think I'd put it stronger than that, really. Because of the truth that God has given us, we have a responsibility to recognize it. It's not atheistic communism that's going to confront Christ. Many thought so. It's not even an Islamic one in that sense. It is apostate Christendom. That's what we've got to look for. All right. We see the headlines come along. Maclean's magazine telling us, Red is dead. Right, communism's gone. Yes. People say, Russia's finished. Well, not according to this magazine, which came out the same week as the other one. Russia Reborn. That's what we're looking at, brothers and sisters. There's a new lease of life. She's being reborn. And you know what it is. When something's born, it's a bit shaky to start with. That's what you're seeing. She is reborn. And I think that put it very well indeed. A very interesting article in the London Sunday Telegraph. In the same newspaper that it was announced Gorbachev kills off the party, that was the main headline, in the same newspaper, on the side, you'd got Europe's new emperor, ? See page so-and-so, and this is the article that it refers to. The Pope being brought forth as the new emperor. Just want to read you, I can't on there because it's so small, but just want to read you one paragraph out of this. With the demise of Marxism, and the Christian revival in Eastern Europe and Russia, the Polish Pope is in a uniquely influential position. The common European home is essentially another phrase for Christendom, to which the Eastern Europeans long to return. Doesn't that exactly put you in the position of where it is? That's John Paul II praying to Mary in Fatima, and well he might, and millions will be brought to believe it. Time magazine 2 weeks ago, an article on Mary, don't know how many of you saw it. The world will recognize in due time that the defeat of communism came at the intercession of the Mother of Jesus. That is the idea that is being promoted. This great event, it will be said that it's come in response to the work of Mary. And millions will be deceived whose names are not written in the Book of Life. And they will worship the beast and his image. Oh yes, they will. Many already do. But that's the way it's going, brothers and sisters. And they will come together, East and Western Europe. I've probably shown you that before. It's Chancellor Kohl of Germany and the Polish Prime Minister meeting together as the unity takes place, and overshadowing and looking at it all over is none other than Mary herself. And so people will begin to worship the Queen of Heaven once again. Brothers and sisters, the enemy of God and of our Lord Jesus Christ when he comes is Christendom. It is false Christianity. Why, you say, is that the case? Because what she does is done in the name of Jesus Christ. And what she does is evil. In other words, it is blasphemy. Blasphemy is a word which means to bring something into disrepute. And that's exactly what it's done. It's changing the teachings of our beloved Master and turning them into idolatry. And, incidentally, immorality that follows as well. She directly injures the name, and thereby the name of truth. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had the experience of trying to speak the truth to somebody, and they will tell you, I don't want to know about religion. And they will recite to you all kinds of things, like wars that have been fought over religion, for example, and the various deeds that so-called religious people are involved in. Have you ever had that experience? It's been brought into disrepute. At one time, you could tell somebody, well, I'm a Christian, and I won't do so-and-so because I believe so-and-so and so, and there was a certain respect for that. Not anymore, there isn't. By no means, brothers and sisters, not anymore. And so we have to recognize, brothers and sisters, this enemy. And in our next class, we want to look at why this is so important to us and, in fact, can affect our own salvation. We must overcome now. But we'll leave it, I think, there, Brother Fred, and discuss that after our next class.